Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in public health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway, and we promised to try to make it a nice program, even though Dr. Shartok just told me that I was mean. I can't believe that. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, Dr. Alan Shartok. And, so don't speak until I tell you to. And
he usually has like a little opening story he wants to tell.
And here's Ira Fussfeld, publisher emeritus of the Kingston Daily Freeman. Kingston, New York, that would be, not Ontario.
No, or the place in the Bahamas.
Oh,
Caribbean.
Oh,
Jamaica. Man. Jamaica. That's
man, that would be a great place to be. Yeah. You can speak now, Dr. Shartok.
I was waiting. No. All is well. And thank you, Rex, for being here. I get your newspaper in the middle of the night, and I say, oh, you've seen that one already.
So so why bother to get it in the morning? By the way, we welcome with this program WBWC in Berea, Ohio. That is just outside Cleveland. And they
is it
now...
really Berea? Are you sure it's Berea?
As opposed to Berea?
Berea.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess
who was the senior police chief under Stalin?
Is that right?
Sure.
Well, I don't know.
What a way to welcome this new
here we have
this new community.
We're welcoming you folks at WBWC, but I don't know because...
I was just trying to throw you off base.
Here we are. As we sit here, there's a place not far from us, a community spelled Berlin, which is not pronounced Berlin.
It used to be.
It's pronounced Berlin.
But after the war, they changed it to Berlin.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, they had a great place there. You could get little squabs for dinner.
Squabs.
Yeah.
And we also have locally a community spelled C-A-I-R-O, which is not Cairo, but it's Cairo.
Like the syrup. Anyway, so Dr. Shartok was complaining that my newspaper, by the time he sees the print product, is already old news, which is a problem. But the fact of the matter is that while newspapers are largely a print medium, here's an interesting statistic for you. The dramatic growth in digital media is this. 81% of newspaper readers engage with the print product monthly. Half of them read print exclusively, but the remaining 49% read at least on one digital platform. So a lot of people are getting print and digital, almost half.
It's actually wonderful. And I noticed that there is a ramification of all of this. So, for example, let me say I go to your paper or the New York Times, you know, just as good a paper, or maybe yours a little better, and I go to the New York Times, and so now you go to the New York State section of the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you not only get whatever they've come up with for the day, but you get the last 4 or 5 days also down at the bottom. So that this is now elongating the presence of a story that may have come and gone really quickly if it was just in a newspaper, a paper type, but now is around for quite a while longer.
It's a really great thing because for years we've had people say, why didn't you write about such and such? Well, they missed the story because they were out of town. And now, of course, it's available to them whenever. And you can bring back stories and package them together and give people context that you wouldn't otherwise be able to give them.
But the essential problem remains, as we've discussed here many times over the last number of years, is that on the one hand, there have never been more newspaper readers than there are now between print and digital. But on the other hand, the revenue continues to go down because print revenue is where most of it derives from, and it is decreasing as circulation decreases. And newspapers, digital slash print, are cutting staff and thus weakening their product potentially. And it's a vicious cycle that we still don't know the end game.
We don't know quite what to do about it.
Well, you know, Rex, I was reading in the paper the other day. I keep careful count on who goes to visit Donald Trump in his palatial digs in New York City on Fifth Avenue. And one of the guys who came to see him for a nice meal was Carlos Slim. Mm-hmm. No, not Anthony Weiner, but Carlos but Carlos Slim, the guy who literally saved the New York Times by giving them a humongous loan for their paper and kept it going. It was a great hero. He didn't have voting stock, but he had a lot of stock. And they obviously have to pay careful attention to him. Well, the Times has been, I think, accurate in their portrayal of Trump. Trump would say that they're after him. So it was interesting to me to see Trump inviting Carlos Slim in for a meal, perhaps maybe a way to get to the Times.
No, of course, he claims that Carlos Slim asked to meet with him. I think they met in Florida. But the question is, regardless of how they got together, as you point out, was the New York Times on the menu or was the U.S. and Trump's relationship with Mexico on the menu?
Yeah, I think Carlos Slim has investments in so many places that I think we, because we're sitting here talking about media, think of him as a media player. But, you know, he's one of the richest men in the world, and so Trump likes him. And I'll bet it had less to do with media than it did with money.
Yeah, I'll
bet you're wrong.
Just to be contrary, I have a better question about a meeting. We talked here some weeks ago about off the record versus on the record, and we had broadcast executives met with Trump off the record, and the New York Times met with Trump on the record. Last weekend in Mar-a-Lago, he had a brief off the record gathering with the reporters who were down there, and then followed it up with some sort of a cocktail holiday party. And I just found myself saying, well, although I don't like off the record, okay, if that's the way they're going to get to talk to him, that's better than nothing. But for him to have invited these people who he's denounced and put in harm's way, calling them scum and inviting them over to have a scotch and soda, I would have told them, thanks, but I'm not interested in having a drink with you.
Well, it's interesting because the New York Times was not there and several other major newspapers, and I don't think the Washington Post was there. But you're right. Look, every time I've talked to Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, who's forgotten in this great shuffle, he'll start the conversation by saying, let's keep this between ourselves. I'm sure you know that, Rex. Theoretically, under the rules, you're supposed to say okay. And if you don't say okay, then you can use what you want. But, you know, when a guy says to you, let's keep it between ourselves, that's for a reason. He doesn't want to be held responsible for what he's saying to you.
It's hard, though, if you're a reporter covering Donald Trump, for example, in this case, or if you're, I think to Alan's point, if you're covering the governor of New York and he says, let's have an off-the-record conversation, and you don't do it, if you don't go to this little off-the-record meeting, this half-hour session, apparently Trump invited these people in for cocktails and shooed them out after a half hour or two. So have a happy party, but get away. Anyway, if you don't do that, aren't you passing up the opportunity to establish a little bit of personal contact that might give you an opportunity to talk to the guy down the road? Sometimes these off-the-record moments are those that give you a bit of a relationship so that you actually have an opportunity to have access to information down there.
Well, you know, Rex, that sounds a little like a whining apologia to me, you know, which is, yeah, we do it and we have to do it and here's why we do it. But it's not good because once you start that stuff, it's like doing other things that you shouldn't continue to do.
Yeah, you can understand that point. There's something to that. There's something in what you say. It's one of my
very little
old friends' great points.
Yeah. Well, we all do it, but I don't like it, and I don't do it. I'm not active anymore, but I'm reluctant to do it and don't do it that often. It just didn't feel right for me to know something, and nobody else knows it, when my responsibility was to be someone who informs the public, not protects the newsmaker.
And Ira, what did you do in the editorial board?
Editorial boards were always on the record.
And yours too, Rex, right?
Yes, our editorial boards are on the record.
Yeah,
We don't go. That is not the same everywhere. When I worked at Newsday as a reporter, you know, the editorial boards would be some that would be on the record. I would be invited to take notes, and there would be some that they would have that would be off the record because they thought that it was valuable to have a relationship between the editorial writers and the principals off the record.
Yeah, you know, Rex, I'm fascinated by the kinds of convolutions that people have to go through, particularly in the press. But I heard recently on our media on our roundtable program, which I'm so proud of, somebody called me and said, or left a message for me and said, I gave $20 to the Hillary Clinton campaign, and I'm worried that the Trump people will be coming after me.
Oh, wow.
Now, what's interesting about that story, which I really think is very important, is the sort of mass paranoia that has been engendered by Trump, who was appointing very right-wing cabinet and very right-wing people in national defense and CIA probably and all the rest. So I'm wondering whether some of that isn't translated. I'm wondering if some of that isn't translated into the way the press is going to approach him.
Well, Margaret Sullivan of the now Washington Post, the media columnist who was previously the Times public editor and the editor of the Buffalo News before that, has written a column where she talks about sort of predictions for the Trump era. And the first thing she points out is that there's likely to be unprecedented conflict between the administration and the media.
I said that in my predictions column, too, by the way.
Is that right?
Well, yeah. Then I was just reading it to Ira.
How about that?
Yes, I can confirm it.
It would confirm it. It's true. You know, the fact of the matter is, when the media report the falsehoods that Donald Trump or his people are speaking, he converts that into a culture war. He turns it into, well, the media is out to get me. In fact, it's not that somebody's out to get him. It's that our job is to tell the truth. And his job is not, as he sees it, his job is to hold power.
But he may even be one of those strange people who are able to convert any word that comes out of their mouth to truth, and what's worse, believing it.
Well, almost all of his tweets end with, despite what you may have read in the dishonest media, there is a lot of blame that the media can absorb on itself for the plight that it's in regarding mistakes and extremism and all that kind of stuff. But the amount of damage that he has piled on is incalculable. How do you rectify the fact that the recent poll said that more than 50% of Republicans believe that Trump won the popular vote? Now, there's no question who won the popular vote, yet more than half of the Republicans believe that Trump won the popular vote. How is an objective or hopefully objective news organization supposed to operate in that atmosphere?
Well, you know, the truth is they should be trying harder. But I'm a little bit concerned about something I thought you were going to get to here, Ira, which is you said there's a lot that the press can blame, can take on itself and blame itself for. The press is unpopular in America, and there are reasons it's unpopular, right?
Yes.
And one of those reasons is that a lot of people have been, it's a political science term, screwed by the press. At least they perceive themselves as having been screwed by the press. Now, I see Rex grimacing as I say this, and I thought maybe he would like to have rebut what I just said.
I think that's not the reason. I mean, you always cite this social club that you went to where people said, I got it wrong. But people who can say, yes, there have been inaccuracies in the stories that they know, and I'm sure it's true that mistakes are made by reporters, definitely. But I think that that's not why people are alienated from media coverage. I just think that piling on decade after decade, it's been now that the official position of a significant share of public officials is the media are lying and you can't trust the media. And that was Spiro Agnew's point of view, if we remember how long ago, in the 1960s. And it has carried through to today. And of course, talk radio is filled with, and I think there's a great irresponsibility on the part of the owners of commercial radio stations, principally in the AM band, who have given license to people to say anything outrageous and not to correct it at all. The talk radio is filled with lies. Day after day, hour after hour, filling the airwaves, and the people who own those radio stations, I'm not saying the government should hold them to account, but I think there's a sense of personal responsibility that they should take that means that the radio band is not just to make money. It's really to tell truth to people, and that is not what's going on. And the result is people don't know what to believe. They have been filled with falsehoods.
And the reason for that is that when a Rush Limbaugh is competing against any of the others, all these guys have to, in order to win that fight, that competitive fight, have to throw more red meat than the other guy is throwing.
Yeah.
So sooner or later, it really becomes a very bad food fight.
Absolutely. So you get the guy who goes by Savage, whose real name
terrible.
Is Wiener,
you know. His name is Wiener.
And he's not the worst, probably. I don't know who the worst
but you
is.
And then you add to that the cable news networks, put the word news sometimes in quotes, and then you add, of course, the internet, where you can find whatever news you want to find. So I'm not placing the lion's share of the blame for the media media's problems on the media, but I do think that over the years that there have been enough self-inflicted wounds on the part of the media that it left itself in a vulnerable position.
What would they do? What kind of self-inflicted
wounds? Just if nothing else, routine. I mean, I used to talk about my newspaper as a small regional newspaper in Ulster County, New York, and read by a steady community of families from life to death. And it's a small community so that almost all of the time there are going to be stories or names in the paper that you know. They're your neighbors, your friends, your business colleagues. And maybe today you misspelled your brother-in-law's name in the paper. Maybe tomorrow you didn't select your cousin for the high school all-star team and that makes somebody mad at you, although that's a subjective choice. And on, some of the ills more serious than others. I would say as a newspaper man, all of them relatively small, but there is a gathering of all of them together in a small community that makes people say, oh, that newspaper stinks.
And you know what? They never forget.
And they never forget. And you know what else?
25 years later, they don't forget.
That it's not unique to my newspaper. I always tell the story when we expanded our readership to Dutchess County, New York, across the river, people would say to us, boy, are we glad you're here because we hate the Poughkeepsie Journal. And then when the Middletown Times-Herald Record expanded into Ulster County, we would hear, boy, am I glad they're here. We hate the Daily Freeman.
Right.
So it's insular, it's incestuous. But those kinds of things on a smaller level have made media vulnerable where people will say, I don't believe a word that's in that paper.
We could take a test, each of us who are listening or participating today, and say, am I guilty of that? Did something happen to me 25 years ago in which an editor at way preceding Rex at the Times Union was very unfair to me, and will I ever forget it? Answer,
And
no.
By the way, one of the most instructive things, and I know you both have experienced it, I think you'd have, is when you are the subject of a story and or an interview in another publication, and you read that story and you say, where the hell did this come
from? That's Alan's point, that everybody knows that there are errors, and that I think that what about the notion that, by the way,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean you as in the public. I meant the journalists themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. You can share in this conversation. media@wamc.org is how you send us emails, and we're always happy to hear. media@wamc.org. We're the media project. Alan Shartok, Ira Fussfeld, and Rex Smith here, the publisher, the editor, and
anyway. The provocateur.
Oh, boy. He's really coming with a sourpuss today.
Happy holidays.
Let's see.
Oh.
Anyway, actually, Carl Bernstein makes this point, the author and Watergate reporter, who says that the fact is that there are more reporting resources available now than when he and Bob Woodward were doing their Watergate investigation. But the difference is that, quote, fewer and fewer people are open to the best obtainable version of the truth. The best obtainable version of the truth is what reporting tries to be. And what we're talking about is people being hostile to it. Is that because, in part, we don't reflect the reality of our communities? That's one of the complaints, that journalism has become a place for, you could say, social elites as opposed to ordinary folks. You could say progressives as opposed to conservatives. How big a deal has that been?
Well, I like the definition very much. I mean, I like the idea of best obtainable because you know, there are many versions of truth. We know that from Rashomon and from everything else. People see things differently. But what I'm interested in is you go into a very conservative community in upstate New York, for example, and you see the signs going after Andrew Cuomo for his gun legislation. And they say this is violative of the Second Amendment, and they believe it, and they think that gun control is a bad thing, and it's reality for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But how much of your question is based on the premise that reporters today can't relate to the people they're reporting for? I mean, there was a time in the earlier days, particularly of print journalism, where reporters weren't making any more money than the stiffs who read their papers. And so what was the line? You afflict the comfortable.
Comfort the afflicted.
But now, although they're certainly not making huge dollars. People who work for newspapers and broadcast are much more comfortable than they once were, and perhaps they can't relate to the problems of people in the world today, in the country anyway.
I don't know if it's dollars as much as it is that journalism became more respectable. And, you know, people self-select for their careers, and people who decide to become journalists are folks who generally fall onto the progressive side of the political spectrum. And so you don't have people from the hard right. I'd venture to say that the vast majority of journalists did not vote for Donald Trump. I'd say that's a very small percentage of journalists.
They all work for the New York Post?
Well, mm-hmm. Even a lot of Post reporters. I mean, of course, most of us would say that, well, that's because he's hostile to the truth. I mean, really, the guy didn't, you know.
But there was a time when, there were always times when reporters, whoever they voted for, it did not make any difference to the public because their work was seen as legitimate journalism. And I think part of the brainwashing that's occurred is that the people who are on the right, for example, are going to constantly say the reporters all voted for those on the left, even though we in the business know that as best as is possible, reporters are trying to do it right up the middle. Mm-hmm. But they're being painted as partisans because they voted one way or the other. Well, they're citizens. They've got to vote for somebody.
Or painted as partisans. I mean, we actually have this even in our within our organization, people not in the newsroom, but who say, oh, you guys, we're all focusing on Trump's problems and you ignored Hillary's, which...
Yeah, we just got a letter on that.
Oh, boy.
And said, you guys have never made the case for... We have two people on our roundtable program in the morning. All they do is talk about Hillary's virtues again and again and again. Our Rosemary Armeo and Libby Post again and again. And the guy writes me a letter and says, I've never heard one good word about Hillary on your show. That's the kind of stuff that really drives you out of your mind.
Yeah. You know, I was actually with one of what I'm thinking of is, though, the folks who I was trying to talk to some of our executives in our organization about the post-truth era of the Trump pending presidency. And the response was, yeah, but what about the Clinton Foundation? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, wait, that's a non sequitur. I'm not talking about. But B, there has been no demonstration of any illegality on the part of the Clinton Foundation at all. Right. Oh, yeah, sure. Well, that's because you're just looking at Trump. And, you know, it is as though people don't understand that there are, you're not trying to find, you have to have an equal number of bad stories, quote unquote, stories about the negatives of this candidate versus the negatives of that candidate, because the scale does not always tip so neatly.
So I'm always interested in the concept of motive. Now, I'm getting a ton of mail now here as a major member station of public radio saying that Morning Edition, their number one popular program, is taking a fall, that they are being too nice to the Trump people. And then people want to ascribe motive to that. They say, well, we know that your member stations get money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Mm. They're worried about that. And that's really why they're taking this fall. Well, I know Mike Oreskes, who is the, and so do you guys, but who is one of the most decent, objective people in all of journalism. He would never allow that.
He runs the public NPR news at this point, senior vice president.
He does. But people won't stop people from ascribing motive to anything they want to see.
So what's the answer?
You just have to keep doing your job. If you believe that truth-telling is a valuable commodity, you have to keep doing it, even though we know that there will be hostility to it. Eventually, you think there's going to be a turn. You know, what goes around comes around. Isn't there going to be a time when the value of independent truth-telling is recognized? Won't that come somehow when people see that we haven't been lying, that we've been telling the truth all along?
Well, that might happen. Those of us who would like to see it happen, it might happen in the Trump administration when there might be an I told you so moment.
Well, as long as there's a New York Post, sorry to bother you guys about this, there are going to be people who say this is not an objective news source. You know, 7 million people buy it.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
there were always partisan newspapers. It's just become more of a cottage industry now because there's so much media. There's just too much. There's so much media for people to choose from. So they go to their most comfortable location.
Yes. whether it's trustworthy or not. Well, that, we're going to have to leave it at that point.
No.
Oh, it's true. It's true.
Rex, I'm so disappointed.
I know. Well, you got to go off and spread some information elsewhere.
Well, Merry Christmas to Rex and Happy Hanukkah to Alan.
Oh, and to you.
Thank you.
Whatever you choose.
Yes.
Whether it's Kwanzaa, whatever you choose, happy something to you.
So the Media Project, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. Ira Fussfeld, Alan Shartok, and Rex Smith. And we hope you'll be back with us again next week for the Media Project.
Newspapermen meet such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks, for readers, and to big shots.